Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, and your chief investigator of images. An exciting podcast today. I am in the middle of filming an exciting new series for the BBC, and in each of the programmes I go to a different amazing location. I got back a few weeks ago from Mexico. Now, I'd wanted to go to Mexico since I was a child. And the idea came about that we would be able to go and travel all along the Gulf of Mexico in search of the Olmecs. Who are the Olmecs? Well, the Olmecs are the first civilization in Mesoamerica. They date back to around the time that the Egyptians are putting up the pyramids, about 1000 BC. So they're much, much earlier than the Mayans and the Aztecs, who we know so much more about. The programme's going to be taking us through the whole process of how the Olmec civilization developed, and of course, the Olmec heads that are those statements of power that appear in all the different Olmec sites. I was able to speak with the expert on Olmec art, Rebecca Gonzalez-Lauk. She's from the Museo de Antropología in Mexico, and she gave me some incredible insights into this civilization, how they made their art, those complicated heads, why are they appearing, what do they represent. It was amazing to spend time with somebody who knows so much about a subject that I find so fascinating. It will certainly tell you things that you didn't know before, that's for sure. Thank you all so much for the support you give, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Very exciting today because I am in Mexico, somewhere I've wanted to come my whole life. And we've been filming here. We're making a series for the BBC about exciting archaeological discoveries. And I'm not going to give too many secrets away about the programme. You'll have to tune in and watch it. But I am delighted to be joined by one of our contributors on the programme and the expert on Olmec art. Do introduce yourself, Rebecca.
Okay, my name is Rebecca Gonzalez-Lauk, and I'm a researcher at the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico.
Fantastic. And you were telling me when we were talking, at first it wasn't Olmec that you wanted to do. You're an archaeologist, you're interested in the Mayans, weren't you?
Yeah, my first interest in Mesoamerican archaeology was Mayan. I had lived in Central America, and I was very interested in the art. It's always what has attracted me.
Right.
Uh-huh. So that was my main interest. But then I went to graduate school, and I sort of got brainwashed by my advisor, and I started doing Olmec.
The Art Detective listeners might not know what Olmec is. Do explain, please.
Okay. The Olmec is an art style. Mm. And it's associated to a civilization that inhabited the southern part of the Mexican Gulf Coast in the first millennium before Christ.
So lower than where we'd think of the Aztecs being, mm-hmm. and higher than where the Mayans are, is that right?
It's in between the Mayan and the Aztec. The Aztec are toward central Mexico and toward the north, and the Mayan, we sort of neighbors with the Mayan,
yeah.
to the south.
There's a bit of sort of shared borders, aren't there, and overlap.
Right.
But the really important thing is the date, isn't it? This is what blew my mind. How early is Olmec?
Well, there are dates on the Olmec, on Olmec art as early as 1600 before Christ. And those you find in El Manatí in southern Veracruz and in La Merced.
This is the thing that really surprised me when I started looking into this. I knew about the Mayans. Uh-huh. I knew that really you could even go quite early with the Mayans, even maybe a bit BC.
Uh-huh.
But the idea that there is a civilization creating sculpture, creating architecture, creating art, 1,400, 500, 600 BC.
Right.
That was something else, wasn't
it? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
There's nothing comparable in the rest of Mesoamerica that early.
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And well, so what's everyone else doing at this time? What's the rest of the country doing?
They're usually small villages in dispersed. The settlements are very small. There's no planned architecture, as far as I know. They're sacred sites. But and obviously there's long distance trade because the Olmecs also traded with them. But they're not organized as a society. They're not organized societies.
So there's no hierarchy. There's no kings, rulers, priests, nothing like that.
No. Uh-huh.
Maybe a bit of shamanism.
Yes. Oh, certainly religious beliefs and things like that. Yes.
Uh-huh. But so something quite distinctive starts to happen, doesn't it? And it starts to happen. We see it first. So we're looking at the beginnings of what we recognize as civilized in terms of city dwellers. But that really starts to take effect around San Lorenzo, is that right? This site, this location, the art coming from it.
Yeah, in San Lorenzo you have certainly the art. They have a sculpture corpus that's very important. What is not so clear is the architecture.
Right.
And that might be because it's buried under the earth. But Ann Cyphers has excavated large structures, but it's unclear the architectural pattern or the design. So we do have some indicators that they had large earthen architecture and they used stone at the same time. But it's not in La Venta where you see the layout very clearly and it's on the surface and you can see the size and of the buildings.
Uh-huh. And I should emphasize to the Art Detective listeners that we are at La Venta site today. Uh-huh. And this is your domain, isn't it,
right,
Rebecca? You've mapped it, you've excavated it for years and years and years. The site that we're sitting in now is a museum. It's a preserved site, but it wasn't like that when you started looking at it, was it?
No, when I arrived in 1984, there were 200 families living at the site. The village of La Venta had grown into the site.
Mm.
But fortunately, beginning in 1985, the state government started working towards the protection of the site, and that's one of the big achievements that we've done. It's the only site in the state of Tabasco that's protected by declaratoria. It's a legal instrument. And it's the only Olmec site in all Mexico that's protected with a declaratoria.
Good.
So in that way, we have been very fortunate. We have a museum with about 13 monumental sculptures that are little known because very few people come here.
Come here, Art Detective listeners.
But there's an ongoing research and conservation program.
Mm. But we have got, 200 hectares in the whole site?
The site, we estimate, is about 200 hectares. We have protected only 100 because we have the town of Villa La Venta. I mean, we can't buy everything. And then Pemex has also, the petroleum company has facilities in the area.
There's so many issues that you face around here with the petroleum industry, with legal issues, with people trying to get Olmec art to sell on the black market.
Uh-huh.
All these things you're up against. And the weather.
Right.
We're hot today. It's about, 42 degrees
probably.
And the insects.
Right.
But with all those things, what I find really staggering, we are on this site of 200 hectares. Tell me how much of this site you think has been properly excavated.
About 1% at the most.
1%?
Yeah,
now, you know I'm baffled by this, don't you? Yes, we've been talking about it. 1%. And I mean, that just blows my mind, because I just want to get out and find more. But there are reasons, aren't there, that it's only 1%?
Yeah, there's, the main problem is always money.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Getting permanent funding to do the research.
Yeah.
We have to compete for funds every year, and the funds are never in a permanent. We get money for 2 months or 3 months or 9 months.
Yeah.
But not for a full year of work. So people go for the assistance and all that, they leave after a while because they don't have a full-time job.
Yeah, and it means they can't build up their expertise, their knowledge of the site. Mm-hmm. But just what's come up in that 1%. But I want to talk a bit about what makes Olmec Art so incredible.
Okay.
In this 1% at La Venta, we have four colossal heads.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How many, four altars?
Seven
uh-huh. altars.
Yeah, they're different kinds of altars, so there are seven.
Because uh-huh. they are dramatic, uh-huh. and right. we can talk about those. Mm-hmm. But also, just across the site, there's all sorts of stelas. There's offerings. What is it? 1,000 tons worth of stone that's interred in the earth is offering.
Right. Yeah.
That is mind-blowing, and that's been discovered.
Yeah. And that site, the massive offerings and the stone from the massive offerings was brought in from Oaxaca. So you can just imagine traveling.
What distance is that for the listeners around the world?
400 kilometers.
400 kilometers mm-hmm. in 1,000-ish BC.
Through the mountains and all that. I mean, it's not flat terrain.
My goodness. And even the stone heads, you know, we're talking about the colossal heads, which some are 20 tons. They're huge. And they're single boulders of volcanic basalt that's been carved.
The basalt was brought in from the Tuxtlas, and that's about 100 kilometers away. And it's basically flat terrain. But maybe they were transported by water, by the ocean and the rivers.
Yeah, because we were saying at the time that this area, La Venta, would have been almost like an island surrounded by water and marshes as well.
Right, swamps, but not an island in the sense it's in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
But it's terrain that's waterlogged a large part of the year.
Uh-huh. And I think what's staggering when we start to compare what's happening here with elsewhere in the world, I mean, 1000 BC, let's say, for La Venta, it's a little bit later, maybe. Uh-huh. But we've got, I suppose, ancient Egypt is creating monumental sculpture.
Much earlier.
Much earlier, they are making much bigger and earlier. But you know, we still haven't got ancient Greece. We still mm-hmm. haven't got the Parthenon. We still haven't got Rome. Mm-hmm. There's still so many different artistic developments to come. Uh-huh. And what struck me the second I looked at the first colossal head was the naturalism, the realism. It looks like a real person. How come? How come they're doing this? At this time, your face says it all.
That's probably why we're working towards understanding that. How they achieved that? No, we don't know.
Yet. It's staggering, isn't it? And it still surprises you when you think about it.
It definitely does. Each head has different facial features, so they're probably representing different individuals. And it was carved stone on stone. So it So there were no metal tools, so it's even much harder. Much harder.
That's the other thing we need to emphasize for the listeners. No metal.
Right.
No wheels.
No wheels.
This is before before the Bronze Age, Iron Age, and before the wheel.
Right.
And yet we have these huge stones traveling 100-odd kilometers along water, on rollers maybe. And we have carving that is having to be done not with tools crashing into a piece of stone. Mm-hmm. Basalt itself is really hard, so they have to get a harder stone.
Right.
And just abrase it, rub it? How do they do that?
Well, we have found sort of chisels and drills and grinding stones that were used to grind the surfaces.
Uh-huh. And are they like almost like sandpaper, or are they?
There's sandstone.
Sandstone. Literally sandpaper.
Which was used usually to polish things.
Okay.
But we haven't yet found a stone workshop. We find clusters of artifacts that are broken up and that we think that we're in the process of working, but really we don't have the debitage so that we can figure out what tools they used and how the things were broken and manufactured.
It's a tragic state with earlier cultures that you often do find the products but not the processes.
The processes. That's what interests us. How did they do it?
I know. And so if we think about these heads, what I find fascinating about the work you've done, Rebecca, you've mapped this enormous mm-hmm. site of mm-hmm. La Venta and positioned the artworks within that site.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about how the site is arranged, because what I think will surprise people is that here we have a pyramid.
Right.
Again.
This is the first, it's probably the oldest earthen pyramid in Mexico, or the oldest pyramid, and it's made out of earth. That was piled up and beaten down and compacted, mixed with sand to make a very hard material. And this was held in place by limestone slabs that were embedded into the earthen mass. And you find the limestone slabs not organized in an organized fashion, but sort of scattered just to hold in the earth.
So the distinction from Egyptian ones, I suppose, would be that there you have great big squares of stone.
Right.
But there's still the effort required to compact this earth into squares, essentially, or rectangles.
Not necessarily squares or rectangles. We didn't find that the two small mounds in Complex 8, yes, you find adobes, the sun-dried adobes. Mm. But for the pyramid, we haven't found like adobes or anything square.
Okay.
It's just earth pounded down.
Pounded down, and then limestone in between to keep it like almost terraced.
Right. When you're excavating, you know that you've touched the surface because it's very, very much harder than the earth that's covering it.
Really? Okay. And I think it will surprise people to know that, 1,000-odd BC, here on the Mexican Gulf, mm-hmm. there is a pyramid. And we were talking, weren't we, about the fact that it seems people across the world just sort of come to these things together, even if there isn't direct connection. Is that what we're thinking here, that this is sort of a spontaneous creation rather than contact with the rest of the world or contact with other cultures?
Oh yeah, no, there's no contact with cultures of the old world as far as we know.
Yeah,
this
amazing.
This is an independent invention from this part of the world. Mm. But it sort of happened the same thing, well at least there are sort of like step platforms and in Egypt they also, the earliest faces have
they
step
do indeed,
platforms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, but it is an independent invention here.
Amazing. Yeah. And there is some suggestion that it may be mirroring the volcano.
Well, that's what originally was thought because of the way the building has eroded. Mm. And so, there's another proposition that it eroded that way because it was a step platform with radial staircases. There were staircases on the east, south, north, and west of the building. So the way it eroded, it became sort of like a volcano shaped.
Wow, as if like the lava's running down the sides. That's quite cool to think
about. When we excavated, it was very interesting because the southern part, in the central part, you did find, that was an area that they didn't have any limestone. We didn't find this, we found one little step, but we didn't find the limestone. So that area was different from the sides where there is a slope.
The pyramid sort of sits at the heart, doesn't it? But then
almost in the middle of the site. Yes.
Almost in the middle. But then there's this. This is the thing I love about looking at your map.
Uh-huh.
You can see where the pyramid is. Then you can see this huge plaza with the elite living, working on one side, and then this separation of a spiritual end on the other side of the pyramid. Explain a little bit about where everything is.
Well, the pyramid sort of sits in the middle of the site, and it to the south of it, there's a huge plaza that's 4 hectares, that measures 4 hectares, has an extension of 4 hectares.
Mm.
And on the east side, there's another huge platform, it's called the Acropolis Sterling. It's 300 meters in length. And on top of it, there were stone canals and stone sculpture and basalt columns. So we think that the elite lived there.
Yeah.
Very close to the main pyramid.
And didn't you find out there are also evidence of artisans, of craftspeople making art up there?
These clusters of sculptures were fragmented.
Right.
So we think that there probably remains of workshops.
Mm.
And this is only the beginning, and there are 3 alignments of structures going south for about 800 meters.
I mean, it is huge. When we were standing up there, it's you cannot explain it verbally how it feels until you stand in it. The pyramid in front of you, this massive open plaza that extends off behind into what is now, again, complete jungle wilderness, isn't it? I think you described not being able to see your hand, or no, say it, because it was something like 5 meters.
Well, when you work in the jungle, sometimes the vegetation is so dense you can't see like 5 meters ahead of you. And like what I was showing you in structure D8, where the altars are, there's a pyramid 7 meters tall, and you couldn't see it. We couldn't see it at the moment because of the vegetation. So that's why when the early pioneers came to La Venta, they weren't able to map the site because it was all covered with jungle and they could not visualize what there was.
And this is hostile jungle too. You know, we've been out there. There are snakes, there are spiders, there are all sorts of things to be aware of.
Yes.
And it is the idea that archaeology is just potentially everywhere. It's overwhelming for me to kind of think, God, what could be out there? You know, what could we find?
That very little has been excavated, so there's a world to be known here in La Venta, and there's still a lot of things that we have to learn, that we will learn from the Olmec once we, as work goes further along.
And there is a appetite for Olmec because of, I think, how beautiful it is. I mean, there's a couple of pieces I saw with you at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm thinking of the young seated man.
Right.
Cross-legged, beautiful domed head, and just this sense of his limbs sitting naturally on his... there was something so timeless and beautiful about that. Is that what you think the appeal of Olmec is?
Well, Olmec sculpture does have something that appeals to us. I always have the feeling I want to touch the sculpture,
tactile,
you know,
very
tactile. The colossal head's a small sculpture, and the other notion of the Olmec art is that it always appears, even though the pieces are small, they appear larger than life. I don't know, it's the proportions or the way the volume is managed.
Yes, because I'm thinking now of offering four, and you have the arrangement of jade figures, the little sandstone figure, and then the celts, these sort of slabs, if you like. And they're jade, that's important too, of course, very expensive. But you're right, that even though they're tiny, they're about, what, bigger than your hand? Just about that size?
Yeah, about 15 centimetres.
But there is a volume to them, isn't there?
Yeah, and that is real. You see that in all Olmec art. For example, the seated figure you just mentioned, the joven de Chiquipista.
Beautiful.
It's a gorgeous piece of art, and that was found in southern Veracruz, and it came out when a river sort of ate or went into a site.
Yeah, like eroded the soil. And it appeared as a result.
It appeared, yeah. That area particularly, Jaltipan, where the area of San Lorenzo, is very, 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 very rich in archaeological remains, not only for the Olmec period, but for other periods too.
But it's just the idea that that there was this civilization that was sort of known about. Olmec, it means rubber people, doesn't it? And there's an association with rubber balls, football, you know. But this whole connection with the landscape. But for me, I mean, it's just how beautiful their art is. I like Mayan art. I find Aztec art intriguing, beautiful, dramatic, abstract. With Olmec, it's more human, it's delicate, it's like you say, it has volume and yet it has intimacy. It's this strangely timeless art. Do you feel like that about it then?
Very much so. And Beatriz de la Fuente, who was the great dame in Olmec art, also would comment on how it draws you.
Yeah.
But what it is about it, I mean, I stand before the sculptures and I look at them and sort of try to figure out what is it that makes it so special, and it's difficult to pinpoint.
Like, it was watching everyone's reaction when we saw the seated figure. Every single member of our team walked past, we were walking past lots and lots of sculpture, everyone on the team stopped and went, wow, what is that?
Yeah.
And we didn't know what it was, but it pulled everybody in, didn't it?
Really? That's interesting.
And that's the first time you'd exhibited it, wasn't it?
Yes, it's a piece that was it is in private hands, but it was in a ranch in Jaltipan, close to Jaltipan. And it had never been exhibited. And kindly, the family let us bring it to the museum and exhibit it.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, but that's also another telling point about Olmec as well, because it's still relatively unknown, because sites are not excavated extensively and it's not all fully understood and mapped out. there is a danger, isn't there, that so many of the pieces have come out of the water, come out of the ground, come out of the earth, and they've just gone into the black market. They've gone off to be sold.
Well, you have to be very careful. There is a lot of artifacts that are called Olmec, and for example, the Olmec masks that are. Well, they say that they're Olmec, but show me how many have been found in context.
Interesting.
And show the stylistic differences between the ones that have been excavated and the ones that they say are Olmec.
Interesting.
So you have to be very careful. In the National Museum, we have the La Venta collections that the Smithsonian excavated, but we also have collections of artifacts that other people like Miguel Covarrubias collected.
Oh, yeah.
And I can now tell the difference between what Covarrubias collected and what came out of the earth. And there's it's very slight things that are distinguishable, and you can at least what they have in Covarrubias collections. My impression is that they're not real Olmec artifacts.
So they could be forgeries.
They can be forgeries.
But you know, this is the eye of the connoisseur, isn't it? I mean, this is the thing: is until you have a body of material, until you can assess it, you can't tell what is a forgery from what could be the original.
So you have to be very careful. Context is very important, and where they come from. And so a lot, I go into museums and they say, "Oh, well, this is Olmec," and I look at it and I go, I've never seen something like that come out of the earth.
And you have seen thousands of things come out of the earth.
And it's sort of like, I don't know if you've seen this seal that came out of the side, very close
to here.
The
bird head one, the roller seal. For the Art Detective listeners, we'll put a picture up. It's really quite intriguing. We do see rollers that are used, are they, do you think, to put patterns on the skin?
Right, or to paint maybe paper.
Or fabric.
Or body paint.
Body paint, And they have like on this one is a beaked head, isn't there?
There's a little bird, and from the bird's peak, two symbols hang, and the archaeologists thought that, well, this is a sign that that Olmec writings, well, that writing started in the area of La Venta. When I saw the artifact, I always said, you know, this is not from La Venta, this is just very strange. And the researchers eventually, like 10 years later, analyzed the clay at the Smithsonian, and it was determined that the clay came from the Mayan area. So that helps, that vindicated my point of view in saying that this artifact, the artifact is real, but it was not made here. And that's the eye that you start developing when you work in a site for many, many years, and you can detect what is from the area and what isn't. So that seal is definitely pre-Hispanic, but it was not made here.
Excellent.
It was brought in, you know, like when Peter Maya came to visit his cousin John Olmec.
Oh, yeah.
She brought a little gift.
I love that. Hey, here's a roller. It looks a bit like something you'd like. Yeah, I picked this up for you.
So that's how it sort of came. And it explains, I mean, they brought in jade. They
of course.
They brought in different things from different parts of Mesoamerica.
That's one of the things that I think we should. So let's talk a little bit about the little figure that we looked at together in the museum. So it's the Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. And you have this jade figure with a hematite piece in its hands. Mm-hmm. And I would just stress again for the Art Detective listeners, jade we tend to associate with China. Mm-hmm. We tend to think, gosh, why would they be prizing jade? And we think of Mayans and Aztecs perhaps as being gold orientated. But jade was worth way more than gold, wasn't it? Wasn't it more valuable?
Well, we don't know what it was worth in pre-Hispanic times, but it was very, very valuable. Mm. It was used in very sacred environments as jewelry or as art, like in this case, figurines that were interred as part of the burial furniture of the person that died. Uh-huh. And in the figure, the little female figure, cedar figurine from Complex A in La Venta.
Which is the Holy of Holies. We've been talking about the arrangement of space. You have the pyramid in the middle, then you have this Complex A, which is, it seems to be the place of the priests, the rituals,
the
ceremonial stuff. And there is this burial of just astonishing things in that end.
This was buried in a in an enclosure made out of stone columns, of basalt columns that was interred into a mound, into the structure A2. And there were two very badly conserved burials of young persons.
Uh-huh.
And each burial was associated with different artifacts. And the female figurine comes from there. Mm. The jade was brought in from Guatemala. That's the only source of known in Mesoamerica for jade.
So we're talking long-distance trade in and around the year 1000-ish BC. Uh-huh. This idea that they must have a surplus, that they must have a well enough organized society in order to free up mm-hmm. personnel and money to get this stuff in, and that they're probably exchanging something back, or right. that there's some sort of political relationship right. here. I mean, that's amazing.
And that they had the specialists to be able to carve this. I mean, not anybody can carve this with stone on stone. I mean, it's very, very, and jade is much harder than, for example, basalt.
Really? Yeah, even harder to carve? Oh, I mean, this is the thing I keep trying to work out. How the heck are they getting these stunning carvings? Mm. I mean, she is tiny. She's 8 centimeters high. And yet you can see every finger. You can see the corners of her mouth turning up mm-hmm. and the strands of her hair. And then the little mirror, that's significant, isn't it? Why has she got this little... Because obviously we haven't got metal, we haven't got glass. So hematite is reflective. It's the closest thing minerally to
having
a mirror.
And it's used as a pectoral, as a chest mm. ornament. And real hematite mirrors have been found in other burials or offerings here in La Venta. Mm. And this was also brought in from Oaxaca, quite a ways.
So there we go, hundreds of miles again.
Yeah.
So materials being brought in from all over the place. And then obviously artisans who are... They're not, we were saying, I made the mistake of saying embryonic uh-huh. earlier. This is not an embryonic civilization. This is a fully fledged artistic community who have trained over generations.
Right. Yes, yes.
Don't you think? They're passing on.
Yeah, because this kind of knowledge you don't get overnight. I mean, this is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of working things out.
Yeah.
And maybe there is, that there's definitely, not maybe, there is a definite difference in scale of what comes later. But the canons, the cultural canons, the codes are already fully established and developed by Olmec times.
And what I'll probably do for the Art Detective listeners in the future is give some examples of some of the symbolism, because we haven't talked about were-jaguars, we haven't talked about rain gods, we haven't talked about maize. We've got uh-huh. all these different symbols, the serpent, the dragon, all these mm-hmm. things, which I'll try and talk about in future episodes. But we have spoken for over half an hour,
okay,
amazingly. But I wanted to just end with thinking, what would be your prize piece if someone listening to this wanted to go away and find a piece of Olmec art that just was the starter to whet their appetite? What would you suggest they go and look at?
I would think the my favorite piece is the seated figurine, the seated female figurine
is
in
it?
The Museum of Anthropology. That was part of a funeral, of a burial. Mm. Yeah, it's a beautiful piece. It's like Sterling said many decades ago, it's a masterpiece.
It is a masterpiece. I've had the privilege, thanks to you, Rebecca, mm-hmm. being able to spend time in its company, mm-hmm. and it just gets more beautiful the more you look at it,
right.
which I think is the sign of a true masterpiece.
Right. Yeah.
I cannot thank you enough. If people want to find out more about the museum, about what you're doing with your work, how can they find you? Through the website?
Yeah, the National Museum of Anthropology has a website. The Institute of Anthropology also has a website. My email addresses are there, and phone numbers, I think.
Excellent. Uh-huh. So people can contact you to find out more.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you can find out more. I'll put some information up on the Art Detective Twitter feed, which is just Art Detective Pod. And my own Twitter feed is at Dr. Yanina Ramirez. You can also help us out by supporting us on Patreon. So every single penny you provide to us helps us to make better quality podcasts. And you could do that by going to patreon.com/artdetective. It just remains for me to say, Rebecca, thank you for your time. Thank you for your expertise. And more importantly, thank you for what you have done for archaeology and for Olmec art. You are an inspiring and wonderful person.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for this interview.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.